The following is for your ears only. I'm David Alpern with an encore of our Voices of the Century project to end this program's 32-plus years on air. Particularly timely today, Lessons of War and Peace. Part 1 features a World War II Rosie the Riveter, iconic NBC News anchor and ex-GI David Brinkley, and a JFK aide on the Cuban Missile Crisis. War and Peace Part 2, with former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara on Vietnam and Ronald Reagan's Tear Down This Wall speechwriter. Next, that's entertainment, with Katharine Hepburn, Norman Mailer, dance master Bob Fosse on Fred Astaire, and Michael Feinstein on the Gershwins. Then the sporting life, memories of baseball greats Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and basketball star Bill Russell. Finally, first words last, excerpts from our debut broadcast as Newsweek on air, plus key quotes from last week's news, all that and more for your ears only, a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For your ears only, for the week of September 28th, 2014, and our last live broadcast, I'm David Alpern with our Newsweek on Air Voices of the Century project and co-host Warren Levinson of Associated Press.
Blues, 20th century blues, they're getting me down. Who's escaped those weary 20th century blues?
A song by the famously world-weary Noel Coward introduced our Voices of the Century project. Interviews with people who made news or witnessed it firsthand, all combined for our December 26, 1999 Newsweek on Air show. Part one focused on recollections of war and peace, beginning with Mildred Crowe Sargent, one of thousands of Rosie the Riveters who kept armament assembly lines going while America's men fought World War II. AP's Warren Levinson asked her how it happened.
Well, there was an ad over the radio where I was living at the time, Nashville, Tennessee, and that it was urgent that people come to Detroit and work in war work because we were very far behind in things that we needed for the soldiers to fight the war. And so my husband said, well, let's go. And so I got up there. Within 2 weeks, I had gone to work for Woodall Industries.
Wasn't hard to get a job.
No, oh no. First place I went. And they sent me to riveting school. And what would happen, the ones who could make it in riveting school went on to rivet. But then the others did other things in the plant. Now, they chose me to rivet, and I was pretty good at it. I beat out the... I was working night shift, and I could beat the day shift and how many rivets I could drive. So I was right proud of myself for what I could get done.
Do you feel like your time riveting changed your life in the long term?
In one sense, I don't think it changed me as much as other women maybe, because I had not worked outside the home, and I did begin to work. And there was a feeling among the manufacturers before that time that a woman could not do heavy work. And after that, they knew that the women could do just as well as the men on the heavy work. And so they hired more women. And more women liked the independence. And I think that boosted the women's movement because of that. And in my case, I raised my family, and then I decided that I wanted to teach, and I went back to college.
Mildred Crowe Sargent in Florida. Next, recollections from veteran newsman David Brinkley on Newsweek on Air, 1993, who told us then that radio's role in World War II partly helped him in get into broadcasting.
Everyone hung over the radio as if it were some kind of icon, and very often using maps taken out of magazines and newspapers to follow their reports on the radio. Almost everyone I knew, and again, I was too young at the time, almost everyone I knew either had somebody in the military or soon would have, and they were all frightened and eager for information about them.
A lot of the legacies of the war that exist with us today we think of in geopolitical terms and even domestic political terms, but you remind us of something that was a legacy of the war that may be even more basic to a lot of Americans' lives, tax withholding. How'd that get started?
It started during the war when there was a desperate need for more money to fight the war. And because in the previous tax system, you and I and everyone, or whoever was around, paid taxes this year on whatever you earned last year. you paid in four quarterly installments for your previous year's income. When a lot of young men were drafted into the Army, and I was one of them, we were paid virtually nothing. We got $21 a month. But we also owed tax on last year's income as civilians. And obviously we couldn't pay it on $21 a month. So the withholding tax was installed at that time under the pressure of war, without which I doubt they could ever have got it through Congress and could ever have got the American people to accept it.
What do you think are the most important lessons that the 40s still hold for us today?
Well, the 40s were began with Franklin D. Roosevelt, ended with Harry Truman. The lesson, I guess, we learned was that when the country needed to be pulled together to do a horrendous job called World War II, it turned out we were well able to do it. I don't ask if you think we could do it again. I don't know.
David Brinkley in 1993. World War II gave way to the Cold War and the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, the discovery of Soviet missiles 90 miles from the United States. Theodore Sorensen, special counsel to President Kennedy, recalls meeting with the president on the Truman balcony during that crisis, October 20th, 1962.
At first, we talked somewhat sardonically about some of the people and characters involved, but then he turned very serious. Nothing light about it, which was unusual for him because he was very good at laughing at himself in serious situations. And he talked about the fact that children, he now so valued the two little children of his own, children would be paying the biggest price if there was an outbreak of war, nuclear war, because they had their whole lives to lose, and yet they were totally innocent of bringing about this Cold War situation.
When you look back at that, and especially in light of what we now know about the hollowness of the Soviet military through the end of the Cold War, does it change at all your recollections of that time?
There's nothing hollow about the Soviet military in 1962. They possessed plenty of nuclear weapons. They possessed enough missile power to deliver those nuclear weapons. When we see the Soviet system in the form of a decrepit Russia falling apart today, it's easy to think that that was just a paper tiger back then, but we know it was not.
Finally, tell me about the situation on the 26th, when you knew they'd back down, the kind of atmosphere, what that was like.
It was unbelievable on Sunday morning to wake up and find that in response to the letter delivered the night before, Khrushchev had agreed to withdraw the missiles, to withdraw them under inspection. The atmosphere was one of pride and joy. I remember talking in his office with the president just outside the cabinet room before the final meeting of our XCOM for that week. And one of his assistants came up and said, "Now, Mr. President, you can settle the India-China dispute." The president said no, he didn't think he would be very welcome there. "Ah," the assistant said, "but today you're 10 feet tall." "Yes," said JFK, "that will last about 2 weeks."
JFK aide Theodore Sorensen. We also heard from the late NBC anchor David Brinkley and Mildred Crowe Sargent, a World War II Rosie the Riveter.
Now a quote from last week's news. The U.S. military leadership is now fighting in the same trenches with the Syrian generals. That was a Syrian diplomat after President Obama launched airstrikes in Syria against key positions of the bloodthirsty Islamic State or ISIS rebel group and a previously little-known al-Qaeda offshoot called Khorasan, which Obama administration sources said was planning attacks on Western targets. The administration denied any collaboration with the Assad regime, while officials in New York and Paris denied any concrete evidence of a pending threat. And more moderate rebels indicated they would use anti-ISIS aid to battle Syria's Assad regime as well. Another 140,000 Syrians fled over the border to Turkey to avoid the fighting. Next, more War and Peace from our Voices of the Century project. For your ears only. For your ears only, we have more major moments from our Newsweek on-air Voices of the Century project. I'm David Alpern with a key quote from last week's news. If we move fast, even if imperfectly, that could mean the difference between 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 deaths versus hundreds of thousands or even a million. That was President Obama at the UN urging other nations to supplement U.S. efforts against Ebola in West Africa with air transportation, medical evacuation, doctors, and medical supplies. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said contributions from member states are falling well short of the 20-fold surge required. He proposed a new quick response UN health corps. Now more talk of war and peace from our December 26, 1999 Newsweek on Air show with co-host Warren Levinson of AP.
We of the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, those of us who participated in the decisions on Vietnam, we acted according to what we thought were the principles and the traditions of our country. And we made our decisions in the light of those values. But we were wrong. We were terribly wrong.
Former Secretary of Defense Robert S. McNamara on Newsweek on Air in April 1995, the first broadcast interview about his mea culpa memoir of the Vietnam War. We spoke with him again last week and asked about the controversial Tonkin Gulf incident that began U.S. escalation in Vietnam.
My first thought was that it was unbelievable. And in a sense, I was half right, because the second attack, we now know from a meeting I had with General Giap in Hanoi, the second attack, which we believed had happened, did not happen. But I thought it was unbelievable because it appeared to us that Hanoi, the leaders of North Vietnam, were making a clear decision to escalate the war. It now turns out that that was not the case. The decision was made by a local commander. We totally misinterpreted what happened, in the sense that we believed there had been two attacks. It's now clear there was only one, and it's now clear that that one attack was not directed or dictated by the commanders from Hanoi, but rather by a local commander.
When you think today of the role of the Vietnam War in American policy, what role do you think it plays?
It plays an ambiguous role, and George Shultz, in commenting on it a couple of years ago, said it was very important not to learn the wrong lesson from Vietnam. And by that he simply meant that Cap Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense while George was Secretary of State, had in a sense concluded we should never accompany U.S. diplomatic moves by the use of military force or threat of the use of military force, other than in situations comparable to, I'll say, World War II. It's the combination of military force or threats of military force and diplomacy in situations such as we have in Bosnia today should be excluded from U.S. foreign policy. George Shultz said that was the wrong lesson. I very much agree with George.
The title of your upcoming book, Argument Without End, suggests there are still lessons we can learn from the Vietnam experience.
There are several that apply today. One of them is don't ever apply U.S. military, economic, or political power unilaterally, except in the narrow case of defending the continental U.S. In Vietnam, we did, in a very real sense, apply our power unilaterally. The French wouldn't go along, the Germans wouldn't go along, the Japanese wouldn't go along, the British wouldn't go along. We're not omniscient. We acted as though we thought we were. And when we've applied U.S. power unilaterally, we frequently make mistakes. That's one lesson.
And do you see the Vietnam War still having an effect on our domestic life today?
I think it has had a clear disruptive effect, although that is gradually weakening. And I think that this new book, as a matter of fact, is designed to further weaken it, to show the mistakes we made and how to avoid them in the future, but also to show that the North Vietnamese made mistakes, and we can learn from that, and they can learn from that. One of the mistakes we both made was to misunderstand our opponent, and that is a mistake we run the risk of making in the future. We don't understand Iraq the way we should. We don't understand Muslim fundamentalism the way we should. We must understand our opponents better than we did in Vietnam. And our opponents, by the way, must understand us much, much better than the North Vietnamese made. They made as many mistakes as we did.
Robert McNamara's new book, Argument Without End, will be introduced next month at Brown University. A turning point at the end of the Cold War was Ronald Reagan's Berlin Wall speech in 1987. Peter Robinson, who wrote it, recalls being told, whatever you do, don't mention the wall. So what to write about? He explored that question at a Berlin dinner party with English-speaking Germans.
And we chatted. We chatted about a number of things, but at one point I said, look, I just have to ask. I have been told by the American diplomat here in Berlin that the President of the United States, when he comes here, ought not to mention the Berlin Wall because you've all just gotten used to it. I flew over the wall earlier today. I have to say it's hard for me to believe anyone could ever get used to it. Could you just tell me how you feel about that wall? And there was a moment's silence. I thought I had made some kind of terrible faux pas, but in fact, it was a silence in which they were gathering themselves, so to speak, and deciding who would go first. And one man spoke up, breaking the silence, and he pointed off in one direction, and he said, my sister lives 16 miles in that direction. I haven't seen her in more than 20 years. How do you think I feel about that wall? Another fellow said, I walk to work following the same path every day, and every day the same young man looks down at me with binoculars from the guard tower, and one of us is a zookeeper and the other is a monkey, and I've never known who was who. And then my hostess, the woman who had put on the dinner party, she was quite angry, and she made a fist of one hand and slapped it into the palm of the other, and she said, if this man Gorbachev is serious about this glasnost and this perestroika, he can prove it by coming here, and he can prove it by taking down this wall. Well, that was it. That was the moment. It was very clear that any accommodation Berliners had made to that wall was a surface accommodation. You didn't talk about it every day, perhaps, because it would drive you crazy if you did. But they hated it. Deep within themselves, they hated it every day of their lives. And when my hostess said, if Gorbachev is serious, he can prove it by taking down the wall, it was, if you're writing for Ronald Reagan, you know material when you've got it.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
I wrote those words. That is true. I couldn't have written them for anyone else, nor would anyone else have delivered them. That speech belongs to Ronald Reagan.
Former Reagan speechwriter Peter Robinson, now with the Hoover Institution. Sadly, the end of the Cold War has not meant peace in our time, as victims of bloody conflicts in Africa, the Middle East, and the Balkans can testify. Back in February of 1994, we spoke with Zlata Filipovich, age 12, and the author of a moving memoir called Zlata's Diary, A Child's Life in Sarajevo.
Those days, I think it was terrible. We didn't have water. We didn't have food. It was very, really big shooting, shelling. I didn't eat for maybe 1-2 days, anything hot. So I was, I don't know, I wanted to tell to somebody, stop this or I will kill myself, but like somebody will hear me and stop that war.
Zlata Filipovich, author of Zlata's Diary, A Child's Life in Sarajevo. She spoke on Newsweek on Air in 1994 and became part of our 1999 Voices of the Century project. Now this quote from last week's news. We have every right to knock at this door. That was Ukraine President Petro Poroshenko on the prospect of membership in the European Union. His office also revealed plans to repeal a law that prevents Ukraine from joining NATO, sure to be even more provocative to neighboring Russia, which last week signed an energy deal to help Kiev, at least on paper. Next, some entertainment voices of the century, for your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern with AP's Warren Levinson and some entertainment interviews from our Voices of the Century project. But first, this quote from last week's news. America and Israel are wicked. Wake up, Muslims. That was a Facebook posting by fired food processing worker Alton Nolan before he returned to the plant where he had been proselytizing for Islam, beheaded one woman, and was attacking another when wounded by the CEO, a Reserve County deputy. Also on Facebook last week, the suicide note by Chicago area air traffic center employee Brian Howard. He later survived the fire he set there but caused delay or cancellation of 2,000 flights across the country. Now this on Movie Magic and more.
Clown with his pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is mean, that's entertainment.
A signature song from MGM's The Bandwagon introduces another Newsweek Voices of the Century project, this time highlighting the men and women who made popular culture over the last 100 years, from the silent pictures through the golden age of Hollywood and TV to new forms and sensibilities of global entertainment.
To begin, we've selected our own conversation with actress Katharine Hepburn, August 23, 1987, about making The African Queen with Humphrey Bogart, and especially the famous scene where Bogie's covered with leeches.
A leech is repellent beyond belief. I made that bug I found this morning in my sink look like a dear old aunt. But a leech is slimy, disgusting, revolting. And I tell in my book what Bogie thought about leeches and how I suggested that he cover himself with them, and he suggested that I do it first. And I certainly never did it. And then we had to get something artificial to stick on Bogey. And Bogey was a pretty skinny fella. So nothing wanted to stay with him. Terrible. Well, I mean, we made every kind of leech out of everything. And I don't know what finally worked.
We also asked about her long career.
I think I've had it lucky and I've had it easy. I've had a period where they thought I was a terrible dud. Now they think I'm a saint, so I've run the gamut, as Dorothy Parker would say.
Finally, all the times that she complained that they were out to get her. Who was they?
Who's they? You. You. And the public, the audience, not in movies, but in the theater. And then there came a moment when I was playing Coco. That's late. That's 1970 or something like that. And I was singing, which I'm not a singer, as we all know. But and I thought, oh, God, what am I going to do? No, I can't sing. And I'd always visualized myself as opening my mouth, and this glorious sound would come out. Everyone would faint with joy. And I thought, they'll just kill me. That's all they'll say. We paid such and such, and she can't sing at all. But they listened, and they were amused, or they were moved for some reason. And I thought, you really are not out to shoot me, are you? It was a warm discovery to me. And I thought, they must like me. That's why they're here.
Katharine Hepburn in 1987. Next, Norman Mailer telling Jack Kroll about making up a dirty word in The Naked and the Dead and how it loosened up the language forever.
At the time, you simply couldn't get near printing F*** K. It was totally impossible. Mm-hmm. Nobody even could contemplate it. Mm-hmm. So from the word go, I started with fug. Mm-hmm. And it never occurred to me even try for fug. Mm-hmm. I didn't go near it. And the book came out. All sorts of funny things happened. One of the editors at Reinhardt, who read the book late, said, oh, he uses that word so many times, we've got to cut it out. Mm-hmm. And then my editor, who was named Bill Rainey, was working to protect it. So what happened was that I was over in Paris at the time, didn't even know about this until later, is one of them was going through and taking out thugs.
Really?
Maybe about half of them, and then Bill Rainey was going in behind him and putting them back. But the what happened is that loosened up, the use of thug loosened up the question in such a way that 3 years later when Jim Jones came, he was using F*** K. Mm-hmm. And then the only part of that story that ever bothered me was that people said afterward, Mailer was using F*** and then the publisher said he had to use fug. He gave in. It never happened that way.
If bad language lingers today, so do the elegant lyrics of Ira Gershwin set to the magical music of his brother George. We asked singer Michael Feinstein, who worked for Ira, why they endure.
There's always the cliche, they don't write songs like that anymore, and they don't. Pop music today is written for a beat so people can dance to it. Lyrics are not as important. And these songs have the excitement of another time, yet they have emotions and values that are important for today. Those songs are very romantic. Gershwin songs have a lot of romance in them, and people want to experience that romance again. And you can live that all through this music. I believe in these songs. I believe in what they say. And I don't look at them as nostalgia, because when something has value for today's world, regardless of when it was created, it makes it contemporary.
And did he ever wonder what George might have accomplished had he lived?
Yes, yes. One thought about that a lot when they were with Ira, and Ira always felt very guilty that George died and that he lived. Ira was 18 months older than George, and it was his kid brother, and we would discuss what might have happened if George had lived, and Ira maintained that George would have gone on to write wonderful, quote, serious music, but he also was very interested in writing songs and Tin Pan Alley music and would have continued to do both. At the time of his death, George had told a friend that he had conceived a string quartet in its entirety, and at one point he said, I've got to write that damn thing down because it's making me crazy, and also he was going to write a symphony, and of course those things never happened.
Singer Michael Feinstein on this program.
Singer-dancer Fred Astaire was eulogized for us on June of 1987 by star choreographer Bob Fosse, not long before his own death. The issue was Astaire's elegance yet unfailing masculinity.
Well, it was masculine, but it wasn't macho. I don't think he ever had to worry about that. You know what I mean? He never tried to be the male. He just did it so well. It was like so poetic to me.
How did Astaire do it?
The people who did work closely with him say he just started improvising to the music, and that music was terribly important to him. And he just started playing around, and from that would grow these marvelous routines.
Did you ever find yourself watching an old Astaire movie and saying, oh, my God, that's where I got the idea for some step or dance that you had done in the past?
Oh, sure. When I first started, I mean, that was how I started. I started imitating him, openly imitating him, saying this is my impression of Fred Astaire. So a lot of moves that I have.
Bob Fosse in 1987. We also heard from Michael Feinstein, Norman Mailer, and Katharine Hepburn in person in her Manhattan townhouse, my favorite interview of all. From our December 26, 1999 Voices of the Century show. Now this quote from last week's news. Full of love, awe, and gratitude. That was a tweet by Chelsea Clinton after the birth of her first child, Charlotte, retweeted by grandparents Bill and Hillary Clinton, whose presidential plans may or may not be affected. Next, good sports for your ears only. Now, speaking of sports for your ears only, from our 1999 Voices of the Century project with co-host Warren Levinson of AP, after this appropriate quote from last week's news. It's just, well, he's my life. There's my family, and then there's Derek Jeter. That was Stephanie Wall at Yankee Stadium for the star shortstop's last home game, for which he drove in the winning run for his 1,627th regular season victory since joining the Yankees in 1995. Now, our sports talk of the century.
The record 100 points scored in a 1962 basketball game by Wilt Chamberlain, who died last week of heart failure at 63, was unarguably one of the great athletic achievements of this century. And it introduces another of our Voices of the Century features, this one from the sports section.
We start on September 29th, 1927. Paul Hopkins makes the long walk in from the bullpen in Yankee Stadium to discover, you couldn't see the game from there, that the first batter he was going to face as a pitcher for the Washington Senators was Babe Ruth.
That's what I did, is walk in from my way down there in left field. You do it by yourself and walk up by all that length of field, and you don't even know who you're going to pitch to. What do I do but just start in and throw curveballs? And I threw curveballs from maybe 10 or 12, and he was still swinging at them and always hitting them, but it was always up in the air someplace, so I said, I might as well keep going. So I continued to throw, and finally he hit one, and it was way up in the air. And I thought it'd never come down, but it landed about 5 or 10 rows in right field bleachers.
As sort of one guy in this club, I surrendered a home run to Babe Ruth. Has that been any kind of special memory for you?
Well, not particularly at the time, but later on, why they made so much of it that I had to believe that it was something special. But it wasn't, as far as I'm concerned.
Former baseball pitcher Paul Hopkins, age 95. He lives in Connecticut.
July 4th, 1939, Yankee Stadium again. A dying Lou Gehrig calls himself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. Ray Robinson was in the bleachers.
He had a packed house. He had over 60,000 people there who, they called it Lou Gehrig Appreciation Day, July 4th, 1939. And Lou, of course, already had been given the results of the Mayo Clinic report I don't believe, from everything I've read and people I've talked to, that Lou was fully aware that he was a dying man, but he sure knew he was very sick.
Now, you say that Gehrig actually didn't want to speak that day.
No, he was overcome with emotion, and the importuning of the crowd started to yell, "We want Lou," and stuff like that. At least many did, and he finally, he did come to the microphone, and of course, you've probably seen the famous pictures of Lou standing next to the microphone.
Did everybody there know that they were sort of living through something that they'd probably remember the rest of their lives?
I don't think so. I think, for instance, if I'd have known the full seriousness of it, I would have kept the ticket stub, which I did not, and I don't think there are many of those stubs around.
Ray Robinson's Yankee Stadium History is subtitled 75 Years of Drama, Glamour, and Glory.
Not all our sports heroes are human. Harry Scott grew up on Faraway Farm in Lexington, Kentucky, where Man of War, the great horse, was standing at stud.
My first impression of him was that he's the best-looking horse I'd ever seen. And as I grew up with the horse, I realized that here was a horse that had a personality of his own. The horse knew he was a good horse.
What kind of reaction did he get at the farm?
Well, the people came. And you must remember, this was during the 30s, when the Depression, and people didn't have a lot of money. People came there daily to look at the horse. Tourists, not in the business, not people of the business, but people that just wanted to see him. He was a hero to them. If you've seen pictures of Man of War, he stood with his head kind of turned to one side and looking out. He was posing, and he did this on his own. He never was taught to do this. He did this as though you're looking at the best there is. And I think this is true of all good horses. I've talked to Penichenry's own secretariat, and he had the same air to him. Citation did. I think all great good racehorses actually know they're good.
They threw a 21st birthday party for Man of War. Clem McCarthy came and did a national broadcast. Now, he actually asked Man of War if his son, War Admiral, was going to win the Kentucky Derby?
And right at that moment when he asked, Man of War moved his head up and down in a motion that you would say was yes. Nobody made the horse do it. The horse just stood there and did it. I think the horse knew.
Finally, the voice of one of the greatest to play his game, Bill Russell, led the Boston Celtics to 11 NBA championships in 13 seasons and revolutionized basketball defense.
It was between high school and college, and I was playing with these all-stars, mimicking their moves, because these all were the best basketball players I'd ever seen. One of the things I wasn't able to do, though, I couldn't finish, because I was concentrating so hard on making the moves that when I got ready to finish, to shoot a shot, I was out of gas mostly, so... One day I decided, what if I had to guard one of these guys doing this? And then so I started training myself to play defense.
Now, going back over all of those years, all of the championships that you won in Boston, I mean, a lot of the focus of those years, people talked about Russell versus Chamberlain. Chamberlain pulled down the big numbers, as he might if you're not a defensive player, but you won the championships.
I knew all the positions, you see. I was a basketball player, and my freshman coach taught me how to play center, which was backwards. Most of the time, you know, big guys learn to play center right away. Well, I didn't. I didn't learn to play center until I was a freshman and sophomore in college. But I knew all the other positions, and so I knew how I could help guys when they had problems. And so what I did for my team was not only did I do my things, I understood their positions, offense and defense, so I could help them out, both offense and defense. On offense, I could set screens for them or give them a pass where they could use it or run the plays properly. And on defense, we'd communicate and I'd back them up.
And today, you look back over those basketball years, and what do you think about most?
The older I get, two things happen. All the bad things I forget, and I'm so much better now than I was then. I don't remember any of the turnovers or dumb fouls or when guys beat me on defense. I don't remember any of those.
Basketball great Bill Russell from our Newsweek On Air Voices of the Century project on December 26, 1999. Now, this quote from last week's news, an odd schism between civil rights and civil liberties. That was Elizabeth Goitein at NYU's Brennan Center for Justice on the mixed record of resigning U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder. He fought racial discrimination by police in voting and elsewhere, but also approved extensive communication surveillance of Americans at home, fatal drone strikes if they seemed to join al-Qaeda abroad, and a crackdown on journalists and their national security sources.
Next, how it all began, to end this final month of memories for Your Ears Only. Back for Your Ears Only, I'm David Alpern with this quote from last week's news. It's been weighing heavy on my heart. That was Ferguson, Missouri Police Chief Thomas Jackson on a video in which he expressed sorrow for a white officer's fatal shooting of unarmed black teen Michael Brown and apologized for the hours Brown's body lay in the street pending crime scene investigation. But Jackson triggered more disruption by attempting to join community protesters. Also last week, a state trooper in Columbia, South Carolina, was fired and arrested for wounding a black motorist who had simply reached for his driver license as ordered. Now, last words that were actually our first, with Gil Gross of the old RKO Radio Network as co-host of the debut Newsweek On Air broadcast on April 25, 1982, and as a guest on our 25th anniversary.
The presses are rolling at Newsweek, and we'll be talking to the reporters, the columnists, and the newsmakers who are featured in Newsweek this week.
I'm Newsweek senior editor Dave Alpern.
And I'm RKO correspondent Gil Gross. Welcome.
Our very first story was on a crisis still confounding us.
No more war. No more bloodshed. No more bereavement. Peace unto you. Shalom. Salam forever.
When Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin and the late Egyptian President Anwar Sadat reached a peace agreement with U.S. President Jimmy Carter at Camp David, it began a new era of relationships in the Middle East. But with Israel's formal return of the Sinai Desert to Egypt this weekend, that era is ending, and there are very serious questions about what will happen next.
We have Newsweek diplomatic correspondent John Walcott on the line with us from Washington. John, with the Sinai going back to Egypt now, what do you see as the biggest roadblock to a Middle East peace?
Well, obviously, Gil, the biggest roadblock is the Palestinian problem. And I think it's important to recognize that the Palestinian problem and the invasion of Lebanon are very closely related. Since Camp David, the United States, Israel, and Egypt have been trying to negotiate some form of self-government for the over a million Arabs who live on the West Bank and in Gaza. They've gotten nowhere. The United States has never really pushed that idea hard. And Prime Minister Begin and Defense Minister Sharon have really been free to pursue their own policy on the West Bank, which amounts to extending a form of second-class citizenship to the Arabs who live there. The problem with doing that is the PLO. The PLO resists, the PLO is armed, it has an ability to kill Israeli soldiers and Jewish settlers. It's controlled from Lebanon. So ultimately, if you're going to pacify the West Bank in the fashion that Begin seems to want to, you have to destroy the PLO where it lives, which means you have to go into Lebanon.
Israel did occupy Lebanon for years, but ultimately had to withdraw. The Palestinian problem continues, most recently with new fighting across the Gaza border.
The first Newsweek On Air also considered a looming war between Argentina and Britain over the Falkland Islands and a familiar battle over the federal budget.
For more than a month now, the White House and congressional leaders have been trying to work out a compromise on President Reagan's proposed budget for the coming fiscal year. For a while last week, it seemed that they might come up with something, but time and again, the announcement was postponed, and in the end, it seemed that a detailed deal would be put off until at least this coming week, maybe indefinitely. David, seems to be a kind of a spectator sport to many Americans. There's a lot riding on a resolution of this budget fandango, the state of the nation's economy, interest rates, money available for social programs.
That's true. And to shed some light on the problems preventing a budget settlement, we've got White House correspondent Eleanor Clift on the line now and congressional correspondent Gloria Borger. Eleanor, at the beginning of the week, it seemed that the White House was beginning to show a little more willingness to tamper with President Reagan's original budget proposal. What prompted that flourish of flexibility?
Well, I think that flexibility has been present for a couple of weeks, if not months, as Ronald Reagan sees the economy deteriorating around him. And I believe there is broad agreement on the part of those that are negotiating, Democrats, Republicans, on what needs to be done. The problem is politics. I think the Democrats are about to conclude there's more in it for them come the November congressional elections if they don't bail Ronald Reagan out on the economy. And I think we may see a stalemate.
Gloria Borger, is there a personality problem between these two most important figures in the budget debate, the president and Democratic House Speaker Tip O'Neill?
Well, Tip O'Neill is always the first to tell you that Ronald Reagan is a fine fella and that after 6 o'clock at night they get together and get along very well. I think the problem here is that they have some very, very basic differences on their attitude towards government.
There were lighter topics, too, on that first show. Atlanta's winning baseball Braves, Knoxville's World's Fair, and black comic Richard Pryor.
Because I was watching TV, man. I was all bandaged up, and they said I was going to die. They said, Richard Pryor died 5 minutes ago. Ooh, no!
Richard Pryor set himself ablaze one day while freebasing, making a potent batch of cocaine. This is a man who shot up his car, said a girlfriend's mink stole on fire, went to jail on a tax charge, has had fist fights with his co-stars, been through four marriages, and has used language on TV and on stage that would make a sailor's parrot blush. But he is also just about the hottest performer around. Richard Pryor is our Newsweek cover story this week, and Los Angeles correspondent David Friendly is with us to talk about him. David, tell us something about the background of Richard Pryor.
His roots are as unlikely, I think, as his success today. He's from Peoria, Illinois, and he goes back to that often. He grew up not as a poor, struggling black man as one might think from his comedy, but in a fairly middle-class upbringing. And I think his success is just so surprising to so many people today, and they view him as a real overnight success when, in fact, he's been in this business for more than two decades now.
We tried adding a little humor of our own.
We would have played more Richard Pryor, but the FCC still licenses a lot of radio stations.
It's called Pryor Restraint.
Joining us now is the original co-host of Newsweek on Air, Gil Gross. What do you remember most about that first show in the early years of Newsweek on Air?
What I remember about it is the two of us being given this assignment and just sort of sitting over coffee in the Newsweek building inventing this thing. I have since worked on programs for large networks with tons of consultants that have expired after 3 months. I'm just thinking how funny it is the two of us came up with this thing that lasted 25 years.
Ending now after more than 32, and so pleased for the chance to do it for your ears only.
Thanks for the memory.
Susanna McCorkle helps end For Your Ears Only. This last show was engineered by Chad Dugatz at Hangar Studio Play It Productions. But thanks to all our engineers, co-hosts, interns, and funders since 1982. Thanks most to stations that carried us and loyal listeners to 32-plus years of weekly shows, now free searchable audio at archive.org/details/For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern, grateful for the challenge of working For Your Ears Only, about which I've often thought,
you might have been a headache, but you never were a bore. So thank you so much. Thanks for the memory of China.
Instead of the usual archive segment, after a month of major stories from the last 32-plus years, this week we end where we began our final broadcast, with Master Showman Noel Coward and a question that seemed particularly pertinent this summer as I turned 72 and considered what else I'd like to do.
Why must the show go on? It can't be all that indispensable. To me it really isn't sensible on the whole to play a leading role. When fighting those tears you can't control, why kick up your legs when draining the dregs of sorrow's bitter cup? Because you have read some idiot has said the curtain must stay up. I'd like to know why a star takes bows, having just returned from burying her spouse. Brave boop-a-doopers, go home and dry your tears. Gallant old troopers, you've bored us all for years. And if you're so blue, wet through and thoroughly woebegone, why must the show go on? Oh, mammy, why must the show go on?
Besides Chad Dugatz this week and his wife Jan for our logo, special thanks to engineers Justin Ewan, Lance Neal, Paul Ruest, and the late, great Dave Nolan. Also to our many co-hosts over the years, especially Gil Gross and Warren Levinson in the Newsweek era, Ginger Otis, Kerry Nolan, our former college intern Isaac Davy Aronson, more recently Melissa Exelberth, Catherine Herzog, Eddie Robinson, and Mark Garber. Gratefully acknowledged is past support from Newsweek, the GateWave.org radio reading service, the National Arts Club, Carnegie Corporation, Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Best Memorial Trust, New York Foundation for the Arts, and ACAM Associates, award-winning real estate management. Thanks all. Now, more of The Master. Enjoy.
We're asked to condole with each tremulous soul who steps out to be loudly applauded. Stars on opening nights weep when they see their names in lights. Though people who act as a matter of fact are financially amply rewarded, it seems when pursuing their calling, their suffering's simply appalling. But butchers and bakers and candlestick makers get little applause for their pains. When I think of miners and waiters in diners, the query forever remains, why must the show go on? The rule is surely not immutable. It might be wiser and more suitable just to close. If you are in the throes of personal grief and private woes, why stifle a sob when doing your job, when, if you'd use your head, you'd go out and grab a comfortable cab and go right home to bed, because you're not giving us much fun. This laugh clown laugh routine's been overdone. Hats off to show folks for smiling when they're blue, but more camille-faux folks are sick of smiling through. And if you're out cold, too old, and most of your teeth have gone, why must the show go on? I sometimes wonder, why must the show go on? Why must the show go on? Now, why not announce the closing night of it? The public seem to hate the sight of it, dear, and so why you should undergo this terrible strain, we'll never know. We know that you're sad. We know that you've had a lot of storm and strife. But is it quite fair to ask us to share your dreary private life? We know you're trapped in a gilded cage, but for heaven's sake, relax and be your age. Stop being gallant and don't be such a bore. Pack up your talent, there's always plenty more. And if you lose hope, take dope and lock yourself in the john. Why must the show go on? I'm merely asking, why must the show go on?